So one of the things that's really unique about this time in history is that, we've really begun to exhaust our planet. For most of our existence on the world, we've been very small, and the Earth was relatively large. We had essentially infinite resources relative to the size of our society. But that's certainly not the case any longer. We are now beginning to exhaust much of our planetary resources because of basically two facts. One is we're a lot bigger as a species. We've got a lot more people on planet Earth right now than we've ever had before, something in the north of 7 billion, possibly heading towards 9 to 10 billion by the middle of this century. So certainly population growth has been a big factor in this pressure on our planet. But also, and maybe more importantly, is the use of resources, our technology, and our economy. I think the important point, though, here is that we're living in a time of unprecedented change. Just in the last 50 years, our population itself has more than doubled in size. The economy grew about sevenfold during the same time. And the combination of those two, increasing standards of living and consumption, plus the number of people, has led to about a tripling of global food consumption and water consumption, and a quadrupling of fossil fuel combustion. So, whether we like it or not, we're living in the time that's changed more, not only than any other time in history, it changed more than all of human history put together just happened during our lifetime. So that's a very interesting moment to be alive, and a particularly challenging one, because this is really the inflection point of our history on this planet. So what has that got to do with all of this? Well, it has to do with the human condition and the environment in two ways. In one way, humanity is in many ways much better off than we've been in the past. I think in every material measure, at least in the aggregate, humans are living longer, better lives with more nutrition, better medical care, more democracy, and more literacy and more freedom than any previous generation. Certainly, we have a long way to go towards perfection, that's certain, but we've made some tremendous progress on the human side of the equation. But the environmental side of the equation is perhaps not so good. At the local scale, we've certainly cleaned up pollution in the West, but in many global situations and in many developing countries, the environmental picture is looking quite grim, essentially because we're running out of planet. We are exhausting so many primary resources and the underlying kind of ecological systems that maintain them, that we're really in great peril right now. One of those systems we've been exhausting, of course, is the human land base that is mainly used for agriculture around the world. So this is an extraordinary amount of land. In fact, right now, it's about 30 to 35%, maybe even 40% of all the land on Earth is used to do one basic thing, that is to grow food. To basically first approximation, all land on Earth that's being used by people is used to grow food. By comparison, about 1% of the Earth's land surface is in cities and suburbs today, but yet half of us live there, but 40% of the Earth's land is used to grow food. So that's a pretty astonishing fact. We have much more land in agriculture than we do in people around the world. We also use an enormous amount of water around planet Earth. And I now live in California, where we're experiencing a tremendous drought that is kind of unprecedented on the historical time scales. And that puts tremendous pressure on water resources, which are, again, primarily used for growing food. This picture is a case in point. This is a picture flying into Phoenix, looking out the airplane window and seeing iceberg lettuce being grown in the desert, being irrigated with perhaps the most inefficient kind of irrigation humanity's ever invented. So we do that. We drain the Colorado River most years to do things like this. And we're now paying the price for it. And I'll tell you more about this a little bit later. But right now, we're probably consuming, if you read Sandra Postel and Peter Glick and others, probably about half of what we might consider the renewable freshwater resource base on the planet, that is water that's flowing across the Earth's surface every year. How much could we use? Well, on average, we use about half of that. And we use most of it for growing food. It turns out 70% of what we call water withdrawals, that is water you take out of nature, like through pumping it from a lake or reservoir or groundwater, is used to irrigate crops. But it's 90% of what we call consumptive use of water, that is water that's used and then not returned back to its watershed of origin. It's instead going to the atmosphere. So this is a really big deal. So again, to first order, all of the water used in the world, to first approximation, is used to grow food. Everything else is secondary. So not only is agriculture the biggest use of land, it's the biggest use of water, it's also one of the big contributors to the issue that all of us care about, is climate change. We normally think of climate change as basically an energy problem, but that's actually kind of deceptive. It's not exactly. About 60% of our greenhouse gas emissions come from the burning of fossil fuels. And yeah, 60% is the majority, but a big share of them, something like 30% of all of the emissions of greenhouse gases, actually come from agriculture. And it turns out if you break it down by economic sector, agriculture, with its 30%, is by far the biggest part of the economy contributing to greenhouse gases. The second largest would be all of the world's transportation, which totals about 15%. So if you want to tackle economic sectors that contribute to climate change, you would have to start every single time with agriculture first, and then things like transportation, electricity, heating and cooling, manufacturing, and so on, are actually distant seconds, thirds, and fourths. So again, once again, agriculture is probably one of the dominant things we do in the planet, whether it's land, water, or atmosphere. So it's crucially important. And so at this point in history, it's pretty clear, I think, that we're hitting many of the limits of what our planet can do in terms of its natural resources, without causing degradation, at least. How long we can do that? Can we sustain that? That's still a question. But for now, we are certainly bumping into the limits of what our planet can comfortably do to sustain the human enterprise. We're seeing that quite plainly. And I think the point I hope I'm making is that agriculture is by far the biggest thing we're doing to the planet, whether it's biodiversity, habitat, land and water quality, even climate change. It turns out agriculture is the elephant in the room almost every single time. So that's a big challenge. How do we deal with agriculture and the environment? And it's more than an environmental problem, of course, because we're talking about food. We're talking about agriculture, something that is crucial to human sustenance, human security, human well-being, and the human economy. So this isn't an optional activity. Feeding the world is not optional. But neither is sustaining our planet. So we have kind of a real quagmire here. It's not just an environmental problem. It's kind of a civilization problem. Like, do you get to have one? If we can't feed ourselves without destroying our planet in the long run, then you know, we're essentially done. So we have to find ways that can achieve both goals of nourishing our planet, providing its economic and material well-being right now, but also sustaining those underlying ecosystem properties we need for future generations to thrive as well. And so that's kind of the dilemma that we're seeing here. The dilemma is, how do we answer two questions, not just one? One is, how do we feed a rapidly growing world and do that equitably and securely and humanely in a way that's good for all of us, we hope? And secondly, how do we do that while still sustaining the planet we depend on? I think it's best to perhaps break that up into three parts to make it a little bit more tractable. I mean, this is a big problem. But if we break it into three little maybe sub-questions, maybe we can wrap our heads around it. One, of course, is, can we meet the demands of people right now? There are over 7 billion people in the world, and roughly 850, close to a billion of us, do not have food security today. Not because we don't have the food in the world, not that we don't grow this food, but because about a billion people, a little less, don't have the economic or institutional or political means to get it. They're too poor, they're too disenfranchised, they're too disconnected from the world affairs to exercise power to get this food, and so they are food secure. Essentially, it's a problem of poverty in institutions, not one of agronomy. But in the future, we have the demands of food increasing with ever-growing population growth. As we add 2 billion more people to the planet, that will add pressure to the food system. But more importantly than that, more importantly in the population, is dietary change. 2 billion people coming to the population is one issue. That's about a 30% increase in food demand, let's say. But if we also look at the increasing wealth of the world, especially the 4 billion people in the world who are now building a global middle class, people in China, in India, Indonesia, Vietnam, etc. These people are joining a new global middle class that we never had before now, and are basically changing their diets rapidly and in massive numbers, and adopting more of a Western style of diet. So that means eating more meats, more dairy products, more sugars, fats, oils, and other very resource-intensive foodstuffs. So yes, population growth is part of the issue, but more importantly is the consumption issue about how diets will change with increasing affluence. If you do the math on this, based on just the current trajectories we're on, assuming we don't change anything, which is always a bad assumption, but if we assume nothing were to change, and population growth and dietary affluence continue to grow in the future, we would have to roughly double the world's food supply to keep up with that by 2050. I'll show you in a minute, that's not going to be possible. So we're going to have to find other ways to meet that, probably by not meeting that. And that might mean changing the demand itself, not just trying to meet that demand. Finally, the question of how do we make agriculture truly sustainable? As I've shown you, agriculture is having huge impacts on land, water, atmosphere, biodiversity, etc. So this challenge of feeding the world today, feeding it in the future as demand explodes in the coming decades, and making this truly sustainable. And a fourth issue I'm sure we'll discuss later in person on the panel, and I'm not going to talk about so much, is, and doing that on a changing planet, where climate change is beginning to rear its head more and more every day in a way that we don't fully understand completely in terms of its impacts on agriculture and food security. So this is a very big challenge. We have to solve multiple problems that sometimes have competing interest, and we have to solve them simultaneously at our first try. We're going to get one try at this, and we have to get it right. So that's a really big challenge. Right now, how are we doing so far in addressing that challenge? Well, in a word, bad. Not as well as we should be. One of the things we've been depending on so much is that the Green Revolution of the last 3-4 decades or so has been tremendously useful in giving us tools that have boosted yields, at least in the short run, through better breeding, use of more nitrogen fertilizers, using of machinery, using pesticides, herbicides, and so on. So yes, we got a good boost in yields. We also had a tremendous degradation of the environment in some ways that went along with that. And that debate about the trade-off of those two continues to this day. But one of the things that is we maybe should have expected, but many people didn't, is the Green Revolution is probably over for the most part. In fact, in most of our most important crops, the ones that feed most of the world, like rice and wheat, are the pillars of food security in the world today. Rice and wheat together, just as two crops, provide about half of the calories of the human diet on this planet every day. Everything else we eat are the other half. So if you really care about food security, rice and wheat are where you probably want to start, and especially rice. So these are really crucial, and we're seeing massive yield stagnation on the order of like 30 to 40% of the acres of land growing rice and wheat are no longer improving their yield. That's extremely disturbing. And with maybe with future investments going back into agricultural research, perhaps we can get more yield gains. But at a certain point, we hit the limits of what biology can do practically in a farm, not in a laboratory. And maybe we have to look for other solutions. So I like to point out that, an energy strategy, we don't only think about production. Well, we shouldn't. I mean, people yell, drill, baby, drill all the time. But we should be thinking about the whole energy system of production and consumption and looking how to balance the two. Same thing in agriculture. For 40 years, we've been kind of quietly saying to ourselves, grow, baby, grow, and not really looking at, well, what are you using the crops for and where are they going? Where are there ways to look at the demand side as well as the supply side of the food system? So instead of just thinking, how do we grow our way to success? Maybe we have to think of other ways, because the ways we're going now, I think, are hitting the wall on what they can do for food security. We're not keeping up with growing food demands right now. That's certainly clear. We're not keeping pace with food security generally because of institutional and poverty issues. And what we're doing today is certainly not in the long run environmentally sustainable. So we're going to have to think of something new. And so I think it's time to look for new solutions that look at production opportunities and on the demand side and see how we can put those together. Over the last couple of years, I've been fortunate to work with a number of colleagues around the world on thinking about this problem, about how can we increase food availability while decreasing the environmental impact on the planet. And we came up with about 5 major starting points that we published in Nature and then most recently with National Geographic and a few other places. And these are just meant to be conversation starters. It's not the full list of all the things we could do, but these are 5 that might be a minimum subset that we should begin to pay attention to as we address this problem together. One of those would be to really focus on deforestation. Of all the things we do linked to agriculture and environment, this is perhaps the worst. We clear rainforests that are rich in biodiversity, that are rich in carbon, that have huge impacts on our water resources and climate all over the world, and we clear them. And we clear them not always to feed the poor, but often to feed the middle class and the rich. For example, growing things like oil palm or soybeans to feed to animals half a world away, or other kind of luxury crops. These are not food security crops. They're middle income kind of for global trade cash crops usually. So this trade-off between the world's richest ecosystems and kind of luxury goods or okay things for the middle class is a very poor trade-off in the long run. If this were truly needed for food security for the bottom billion of the world, that might be one thing, but it's not. And so this is a bad trade-off. Instead of clearing rainforest for food that we maybe don't want to grow in the first place, maybe we should look at the land we've already cleared, habitats that can't be further impacted, and ask, how do we get more value out of those? We often have been focusing our investment at the kind of top of the pyramid of agricultural production, places, you know, here like Iowa and maybe Western Europe, I should say, parts of China, where agricultural production is very high now. But we also need to be looking at the kind of base of the pyramid across Latin America, parts of Africa, even Eastern Europe, where yields are massively lower than they should be. These are some of the most fertile lands in the world, yet their yields are only about 20% to 30% of what their agronomic potential is right now, mainly due to mismanagement, land tenure issues, and so on. During the Soviet era, but even worse, post-Soviet era, the yields actually dropped a bit after the dissolution of the USSR. So we have a lot of opportunities to kind of focus on base of the pyramid solutions to boost yields where they're already low, and often with very low-tech approaches, you know, GMOs and other things not required here. Most of this is water and manure would help a lot. very simple kind of smallholder approaches would be tremendously useful and might be good things to think about. So base of the pyramid solutions for food security. We also have to think very carefully about how we grow food in terms of efficiency. We use an enormous amount of water and chemicals to grow food. How do we get more food per unit of water or per unit of chemical use, and especially per unit of chemical pollution that might go along with that? One thing we've looked at very carefully is how irrigation is used around the world. What we find is that, let me put it this way. You can't really think, I've been teaching this stuff for years, and I've asked my students a long time now, could you invent a machine that is more efficient at wasting water than that? And no one has been able to do it yet. An open swimming pool couldn't evaporate water this fast. In fact, I mean, it's perfect. You want to put the water in little droplets, shoot it out at a 45-degree angle for a maximum trajectory in the air, during the bright sunshine, during the day where it's not even cloudy. I mean, this is an evaporation machine, not an irrigation machine. Really, it is. It's only by accident that some of that water enters the soil. But if you go to Israel, you'll find that they're using drip irrigation techniques, which are much better because the water goes into the soil right where the roots are, which is kind of where you want it in the first place, not up in the air. So we have a long way to go. If we follow our Israeli friends, perhaps we could do far better. In fact, what we're finding is that how much water it takes to grow one food calorie in Israel is about 100 times less than it is, let's say, in Pakistan or India. So the same amount of water can grow 100 times more food in Israel with the same kind of climate as it does in Pakistan, for example. So that's a response to water security that's really interesting and one that we may want to emulate around the world a bit more. So there are tenfold and hundredfold improvements in the efficiency of using water to irrigate crops around the world, which is the biggest use of water on Earth. In California, we certainly have a lot of room to go here too, but much of the world does. It's also true for nutrients, I should say, too, and fertilizer use and chemical use. Even if short of going extremely into the organic and agroecological approaches, which I personally prefer, but there are a lot of midway places where at least reducing the use of fertilizers, maybe by a factor of two, could still maintain high yields by being more precise in the timing and location of how we deploy chemical inputs to agriculture. So there's also maybe 100% improvements in things like runoff and so on that are totally possible with better technology and just a little bit more care to agricultural inputs. Finally, though, just to kind of wrap this up, another area we cannot avoid, in fact, this is where most of the answer will be, isn't on the yield side, but it's on the demand side. All the math points to this. All the numbers point that this is where the big opportunity space really is. It's around diets and biofuels. Those are touchy subjects. But food waste maybe isn't so much. Well, unless there's a lobbyist from like the Food Waste Association. Is there one? I mean, is there anybody pro food waste? Okay, I figured in Washington there's got to be one. But I haven't met that lobbyist yet. But for diets and biofuels, well, that's tricky because there's a lot of societal interest here. But food waste, I think we can all agree reducing food waste is probably not a bad idea. But diets and biofuels are important, too, because of physics. You can't convert plant material to animal material with 100% efficiency. Just cannot happen. So this is American agriculture, which is probably some of the most efficient in the world, at converting grains into animal products. If we turn it into milk, we get about 40% of the calories that were in the corn and soybeans come out as milk. That's remarkably good, actually. Eggs, 22%, pork and chicken and stuff like this, about 10%. Beef's more like 3%. So for every 100 calories of corn that we could eat, you'll get about 3 on a plate of boneless beef. 3% efficiency. That's not good. If you're trying to feed the world, being 3% efficient as something probably isn't the best starting point. That doesn't mean cut this out altogether. I'm not suggesting that. But it's maybe looking at this whole spectrum of animal agriculture and asking what's the right mix? Or could some of that beef be displaced onto things we couldn't have eaten, like grass, instead of corn and soybeans, which we humans can eat? So it's kind of a question of how we deploy animal agriculture, not turning it off altogether, that could get a lot of efficiency improvements here, especially at this end of the spectrum. And it's especially important because there are two fundamentally different worlds in agriculture on the planet right now. There's the green world here in Africa, through the Mediterranean countries like Italy and Portugal and Turkey, through the Middle East, through India, China, and so on. Also, interestingly, California, through much of Latin America. That's the world that feeds people. The crops that are grown there are fed directly to people. It's things like corn and soybeans are not there. It's more rice and wheat, fruits and vegetables, roots and tubers, things like that, that are people food. They end up in your plate as is. The red areas, though, including much of the American Middle West, a lot of Western Europe and some parts of Brazil and Argentina, are growing mainly a mixture of people food, but mostly animal and biofuel feedstocks. So in like Minnesota, where I used to live until very recently, 87% of the farmland in Minnesota is growing something for non-human consumption, mainly animal feed. Now we do eat the animals later, but sometimes with 3-10% efficiency. So that's a big opportunity. All those red places are producing food at probably 10% to 5% the efficiency of all the places that are green. So that's a huge opportunity. In fact, the United States, we could feed about 20 people per hectare of farmland. We actually feed about 5 in our agriculture, which is about the same as Bangladesh does today. They grow a lot less, but they feed a lot more with it than we do. So it's not just what you grow, it's what you grow and how it's eaten and what happens later in the food system. Yields are not enough. We shouldn't just be measuring bushels per acre, we should be measuring mouths fed per acre. And that's probably a more important metric. And that doesn't make American agriculture look very good sometimes. So 55% of what we grow in the world is consumed as food, about 45% is not. That's pretty interesting. And in addition to that, beyond that biofuels and meat kind of discussion, which I know is controversial, but we can probably talk about it some more. In addition to that, whether it's plant-based or animal-based agriculture, an additional 30-40% at a minimum of food is wasted in the world. In rich countries, it's often wasted near the consumer, in our refrigerators, restaurants, and cafeterias, and so on. But in poor countries, it's also a similar number, about 30-40%. It's stubbornly high almost everywhere in the world, but it's often near the farmer. And it's where maybe the food didn't get to market because it rotted, spoiled, or got lost in transit somewhere along the way because of poor supply chains and poor infrastructure. So it's not only a loss of food, it's a double tragedy of loss of income as well to people who desperately need it. So that's the bottom line. You know, if we can think about things like deforestation, growing food where we can, the base of the pyramid, massive improvements in efficiency, rethinking diets, and rethinking food waste, we have about 5 levers. If we pulled in tandem together, we have a very good chance of actually pulling it off, that we could feed the world and sustain the planet. If you do at least those 5 things, and hopefully more, we can actually address this problem. But there's no silver bullet. There may be a lot of silver buckshot here, but there's no silver bullet at all in this problem. It's very complicated. But the good news is solutions certainly do exist. A lot of them are getting action now, which is excellent. A lot of them need a lot more attention. That's very good too. The hardest thing, though, of course, is not only we have to change agriculture, we have to do the hardest thing at all, is change how we think about agriculture and how we subsidize it, how we fund it, how we think about it in our economic and political systems, and how we value this whole system and what it produces. That may be the most difficult change, is the social and political one, not the technological. So that's what we have to do, figure out how to produce more with less. Instead of grow, baby, grow, it's grow more with less. And also use what we already have better. Those are the two new memes we have to have in agriculture to really be successful in moving this forward. So with that, I guess I'll end on a more optimistic note of saying, you know, actually, there's a lot of reasons to be very optimistic about this problem. We've identified it. We do seem to know what the problem is. We identify that there are solutions out there that can be taken to scale. There are huge economic and political obstacles, but there are no biological or physical ones to doing this. It's really in the social side of the equation, which is always the most stubborn, but the one that we can perhaps really work on together in the coming years. And I think we have the tools we need to solve this problem. We just have to make a choice now between, you know, the world we have today and the agriculture we've accepted versus the one we should have in the future as we move forward.